Well, that was absolutely beautiful. Let me tell you a little story to start with. Aaron Wesley wanted to be a gospel preacher, and so that's what he started doing. In 1925, somebody offered him a scholarship to attend college, and he was such an outstanding student, he got his bachelor's degree and his master's degree and his PhD in physics and became one of the leading physicists in the nation. In fact, he invented something that you've used today several times. He invented the turn indicator on your automobile. Had to sell that in the Depression for just a little bit because he was out of money. He went to Tennessee Tech. While there, he had more of his students working on the atomic bomb at Oak Ridge than any other scientist. He was a well-known, well-respected scientist. And he just up and quit his job, moved to a little college down in Florida, called Florida College, and became the dean of that college and taught physics there. And he's not remembered for any of those things, I don't guess. But he wrote a couple of songs while he was there. And those songs are the ones we just sung. Our God, He is alive. How beautiful. Lord, I believe. And here's a man who during that time in the 60s and 70s when people were saying, well, I don't believe in God. Here was a great scientist saying, Lord, I believe. And when people were saying that God is dead, he wrote, there is a God. He is alive. In Him we live and we survive. From dust our God created man. He is our God, the great I Am. Aaron Wesley Dykus, Brother A.W. Dykus wrote those two songs. And I'm so thankful that we were able to have those songs prior to the lesson. Now, in the lesson tonight, we want to talk about some things that will hopefully build up our faith. We're going to talk about some Christian evidences tonight. And I hope these are some things that will help us as we are on our journey and we try to understand more about God and we try to share with people things about God. There are some proofs in the Bible that to me are just absolutely fascinating. And last year I spent several months off and on working on some of these things that I just didn't know anything about prior to the time of study that I wanted to share with you. And I hope it'll be good for us to look at some of these things. And the title of the lesson is Moses and His Lucky Guesses or Scientific Foreknowledge from God. And what we're going to do is go back and look at some things that Moses wrote that Moses really didn't probably understand why he wrote them anyway. And some laws that Moses gave, and he probably didn't understand why he gave the laws. But I want to suggest to you that God gave him the information. That's what we need to get from this. So when we talk about scientific foreknowledge, we're talking about knowledge or information that was recorded in the Bible prior to that knowledge being commonly known to man. I have another lesson called How Do I Know God Exists? And I deal with a number of these things. I'll list quickly for you here. For example, the earth is round, Isaiah 40, verse 22. In the time of Columbus, they thought they would sail off the end of the world. You know, they thought the world was like a plate. But Isaiah talked about the earth being round. Psalm 8, verse 8, the paths in the sea. It was in 1857, I believe, that Matthew Fontaine Maury wrote his book, The Paths in the Seas. After reading this passage to his young son, he was a naval officer and later became the commander of the Confederate Navy and the inventor of the torpedo. But he's remembered as being the pathfinder of the seas. Job 38, several things in Job 38. It's an interesting passage. But in verse 16, the fountains under the oceans, this was proven in the 1940s. Treasures in the rain and snow, also mentioned in Job 38. And we've learned in recent years that indeed, there's nitrogen and other things in the rain and snow that replenish the earth. Jeremiah 33:22, and at least a couple other places in the Scriptures, the Bible tells us that the stars of heaven cannot be numbered. And yet, people tried to do that over the years. And finally, when the telescope was invented, people said, you know, we just can't number all of them. Well, the Bible told us that all along. And so it was foreknowledge. It was knowledge before it was commonly known to man. Now, that color doesn't look right, but I don't know how this happened. I want to talk about germ control according to Moses. Now, the term germ did not exist until 1882. And it was not germ, it was germ plasma. And so it's only been in the last 140 years or so that that term even existed. And yet Moses wrote a lot about germ control. And I think as we look at some of these things, it'll help increase our faith as we realize that, you know, God was really behind all of this. But in order to talk about this, I've got to spend some time setting this up. We call it education set induction. I've got to set up the lesson for you. I don't apologize for that, but I want you to know that there is a scriptural point to everything I'm going to say. It'll just take me a little while to get there. And I want to introduce you to George Ebers. In 1862, George Ebers found a papyrus manuscript that was 110 pages long that was written in 1500 B.C. And it was a medical book. And it told about ancient Egyptian medical practices. Now, the interesting thing about this is that Moses lived about 1500 B.C. So this is a book that would be contemporary with Moses. And when you think about the things that are written in this book and compare it to the things that are written in the Bible, they're completely different. Why didn't Moses write in the Bible things that were written in this book? Well, I'll share something with you. As we talk about the medical practices during the time of Moses, for example, under the section titled, What to Do to Draw Out Splinters in the Flesh, a remedy is prescribed consisting of worm blood, mole, and donkey dung. You better hope you didn't get a splinter and go see the doctor in ancient Egypt. Dr. S.I. McMillan noted that dung is loaded with technospores and a simple splinter often resulted in gruesome death and lockjaw. I read a lot about Dr. S.I. McMillan's book, and I found a couple of copies on the internet. You can probably look this up if you go to abebooks or laborers.com. I think I paid a dollar a piece for these. Fascinating book. Great information. It's called None of These Diseases. Well, Moses must have known about this because the Bible tells us over in Acts chapter 7 at verse 22 that Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. He must have known what the medical practices of the day were. He was an educated man. He knew what was going on. And yet he writes things in the Bible that are just absolutely completely different. Now again, to set up this lesson, I've got to give you another story or two. And I'm going to talk to you about Dr. Ignaz Semmelweis. And Dr. Semmelweis was in Vienna, in Austria. He was an Austrian. And he was at the Vienna Clinic in 1847. He was over a section in the hospital. This division, the first division, was the division that delivered babies. And one in six women were dying in one of the best obstetrics training hospitals in Austria, while only 3% of the mothers died when attended by midwives. Ladies, you didn't want to go to the hospital to have your baby. You might not survive. If you'd had it home, your chance of survival would be much greater. As Semmelweis contemplated his dilemma, he watched young medical students perform their routine tasks. Each day the students would perform autopsies on the dead mothers. Then they would rinse their hands in a bowl of bloody water, all of them in the same bowl, wipe them off on a common towel, a shared towel, and immediately begin internal examinations of the still living women. Can you imagine that? That was common practice. And so Semmelweis looks at this and he says, there's something wrong here. There's some kind of connection between the dead people and the living people. And so he begins requiring doctors to wash their hands in chlorinated water and dry them on clean towels. And the death rate dropped from 18% to 1% and sometimes to 0%. Now you would think that Dr. Semmelweis would be hailed as some kind of great person who'd come up with some kind of great medical breakthrough. But the opposite was true. He was ridiculed. He was fired from his job at Vienna. His writings were repeatedly rejected by the scientific community. He was sent to Budapest, and there he implemented his procedures, and the death rate at that clinic dropped to 1%. The guy is successful, but you know what all the doctors were saying? He is crazy as he can be. And his wife even thought that. She thought he was crazy. His contemporaries, including his wife, believed that he was losing his mind, and in 1865 he was committed to a mental institution. Semmelweis died there only 14 days later, possibly after being severely beaten by guards. He was 47 years old. He got no respect. Today, the leading medical center in Vienna is called the Semmelweis Hospital. They finally figured out this guy knew what he was talking about. According to many of the most prevalent theories at that time, diseases were caused by atmospheric conditions or cosmic telluric influences, dark clouds of evil. Semmelweis was ridiculed for trying to persuade his fellow physicians to wash their hands before treating patients. And so you know what happened. You know what caused all that. Let me talk about James A. Garfield for just a moment. James A. Garfield spent some time in Athens. He preached in this county. He preached at Mooresville in 1862. He was a gospel preacher, converted hundreds of people, baptized hundreds of people when he was in his 20s, became a college president at the age of 27, became a U.S. general at the age of 31. He was the youngest U.S. general in the United States Army. And 6 months before that, he didn't know anything about military science, but he was so brilliant, he just absorbed it all. He got all the books and read it and so forth. President Lincoln himself determined this man's going to be a general. He said he was so brilliant he could take a pen in each hand and simultaneously write in Greek and Latin. Just a very brilliant man. And he was only in the Army a short time. And after the Battle of Chickamauga, he was promoted to Major General and sent on to serve as a congressman. He was the 20th President of the United States. By the way, Athens had a tough time during the Civil War. Some of you may not know this. It was a fellow by the name of Colonel Turchin. Colonel Turchin was a Union general, and his men raped and robbed and pillaged and just devastated people in Athens during the war. And he was arrested, and he was tried, and the judge was James A. Garfield right here in Athens. But the interesting thing about this, he was elected president became president in 1881, January of 1881. 4 or 5 months later, he's getting ready to go to Williams College, his alma mater, to attend graduation. He's in the train station, and Charles Gateau, a man who wanted a political position from Garfield and was denied, took a gun and shot him. And so it was not really all that bad a wound, but guess what happened? Over 20 doctors stuck their unwashed finger in the bullet hole to try to find the bullet. And they just filled him full of diseases. And he died of infection in, I think, October of that year, just a few weeks prior to his 50th birthday. That's in 1881. That's 130 years ago. And the word germ was not even in the language of anybody. But now, let's talk about Moses. And he talked about germs, even though he didn't use the term. He talked about how to deal with germs. Did you know that? And I find this fascinating. We're going to talk about how to make water purification. In Numbers chapter 19, we find that Moses talks about this. I want you to open your Bibles to Numbers chapter 19. And we're going to look at what Moses says about folks that touch a dead body. You remember when Semmelweis had all these medical students and they touched dead bodies and they touched living bodies? And he said, there's something happening here. Guess what Moses said? Numbers 19, verse 2. This is the ordinance of the law which the Lord has commanded, saying, speak to the children of Israel that they bring you a red heifer without blemish in which there's no defect and on which a yoke has never come. Look at verse 5. Then the heifer shall be burned in its sight. Its hide, its flesh, its blood, and its offal shall be burned. And the priest shall take cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet and cast them into the midst of the fire, burning the heifer. Look at verse 9. Then a man who is clean shall gather up the ashes of the heifer and store them outside the camp in a clean place, and they shall be kept for the congregation of the children of Israel, for the water of purification, it is for purifying from sin. Well, it purifies from something else, too. Verse 11, he who touches the dead body of anyone shall be unclean 7 days. And what do you do during the 7 days? He shall purify him with water on the third day, and on the seventh day, then he will be clean, but if he does not purify himself on the third day and on the seventh day, he will not be clean. Whoever touches the body of anyone who has died and does not purify himself defiles the tabernacle of the Lord. That person shall be cut off from Israel. He shall be unclean because the water of purification was not sprinkled on him. His uncleanness is still on him. And you look at all that and say, man, That is some weird concoction they came up with, isn't it? Well, he gives that recipe for us. Not in great detail, but he tells us what goes into it. Take a red heifer, burn it to ashes, add cedar wood, add hyssop, scarlet wool, burn them together, pour water over it. Now, time out. I got a question for you. Some of you older folks know the answer to this question. How do you make lye soap? Well, I didn't know, but when I read that, I thought that kind of sounds like making lye soap. So I went on the internet and found out how to make lye soap. Lye, also commonly known as sodium hydroxide or caustic soda, is used in making soap. It's easily made at home. And then the internet says, well, here's the steps. You gather a bunch of logs or brush or leaves or whatever that's really dried out good, and you burn it in a pile outside or in the fireplace or in a wood stove. And then you take this barrel that's got a hole in the bottom of it with a stopper, and you put all that in there, and you fill it up. And then you put a hole in the bottle and you pour water, soft water. Rainwater is what the old folks always used, didn't they? They'd catch the rainwater to make their soap with. And they'd pour it over it, and they'd let it set for 3 days, and then they'd check it to see what the lye was like, and then they'd add lard to make the soap. That's what made it solid. Guess what? The Jews didn't have pigs, right? So they didn't have the lard. You've got a bottle out here. Antibacterial stuff that I used last night, and several of you did. This is Moses' version of antibacterial soap 3,500 years ago. Somebody says, now, Frank, I think you're stretching it. Take a red heifer, burn it to ashes, add cedar wood, add hyssop, scarlet wool, burn them together. I want to suggest to you, well, I'll tell you, I don't know what all this means. But I want to tell you, I know what some of it means. Hyssop wood contains high levels of thymol. And it's used today, still used today, to kill germs. It's used in mouthwash today. It's interesting that David said in Psalm 51:7, purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Listerine has thymol in it. Now, being the tightwad I am, I went to the Dollar General and got the knockoff version of Listerine. Same thing. Same shape bottle, everything's the same except the name up there. But on the back, if you turn it over, you will see thymol. Why? It's an antibacterial agent. Moses said you use hyssop. It has an antibacterial agent in it. Did you know the original purpose of Listerine was not to wash your mouth out with? It was a surgical antiseptic. That was the original purpose of it. And then they watered it down and they made a mouthwash out of it. So you can buy products today that have thymol in it, and it's pretty good stuff. It still kills germs just like it did 3,500 years ago. Well, hyssop also contains high levels of carvacrol. I learned this about the thymol from Apologetics Press out of Montgomery. It puts out a lot of great material, scientific kind of material for Christians, and you may not be familiar with that, but you can go on the internet, apologeticspress.com, get some great material from them. And so I learned about the thymol, but as I began to study this, I found something else that it has that's an antibacterial agent, and that's carvacrol. And so I wrote the folks down there and told them about the carvacrol, and they thought that was great. They said they'd use that now. And it is a natural and biodegradable disinfectant that is found in hyssop. In fact, it's so strong, the antimicrobial activity of carvacrol was observed in concentrations as low as 0.07%. A little bit of carvacrol goes a long way, we would say today. What did it do? It killed germs. That's what it was for. Now, the most prevalent way of getting carvacrol today is from oregano seed. But hyssop has high levels of carvacrol. Thymol and carvacrol are natural plant chemicals with antimicrobial properties. Hyssop oil bears 50% carvacrol, which is an antifungal agent and antibacterial. How did Moses know that? Was it just a lucky guess, Moses, that you came up with this idea of using hyssop? But then he says, take a red heifer and burn it to ashes and, and add cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet wool and burn them together. Now, I don't know what all that means, but I'll tell you something about scarlet wool. Do you know what happens to wool when you burn it? Forms little tiny balls. And if you men that's ever worked in the shop and got your hands good and oily and nasty, you probably had you some stuff there to clean your hands, like Fast Orange or Gojo. And it has pumice in it, which is little gritty things. And those little gritty things get down into all those little cracks in your hand. That's what burnt scarlet wool does. And so God says you use burnt scarlet wool in your water of purification. Well, was that just a lucky guess on Moses' part? Or was that scientific foreknowledge from God? I want to suggest to you that that was scientific foreknowledge. Now I want to share something else with you. We're going to talk about cutting boards, wood and plastic. And I have, as I said, another sermon called How Did I Know God Exists? And I had this point in there and I took it out and put it in this lesson. Because I think this is fascinating. Now, don't get lost. We're going to talk about what the Bible says about this. The Bible talks about these things, okay? You're doubting me, I can tell. You're looking at me like, I don't know about that, Frank. So, here's wood and plastic. Which is better? I remember one year at school, I went in the lunchroom at the beginning of the year, and man, they had put some tops on those old stainless steel counters. Wood about that thick, about that wide, and about 9 feet long. Must have cost thousands of dollars. It was absolutely beautiful. Cutting block. I came back a short while later, and you know what they put on top of that? About a 1-inch, 1 1/4-inch piece of plastic with no seams and covered the whole thing. I said, boy, that's a good idea because that'll keep all that nasty old chicken juice from getting down in that wood causing problems. But as Lee Corso says, not so fast, my friend. Listen up. You may learn something. Let me introduce to you Dean Cliver. Dean Cliver is one of the top microbiologists in the country. And he's with the Food Safety Laboratory and World Health Organization. He is at the Center of Food Virology at the University of California in Davis. Well, he decided he was going to do some tests with cutting boards. So he got him some wood cutting boards. 10 different kinds of wood. And he inoculated them with some pretty nasty germs. E. coli and salmonella and the one I can't pronounce and listeria. By the way, it was last year that 28 people died from listeria and cantaloupe. You remember that? And staphylococcus, you heard of that? These are pretty nasty bugs, aren't they? We've heard of these things. And so he inoculates all of these things with it. Well, he uses 10 different kinds of wood, including hardened maple and birch and beech and black cherry and basswood and butternut and American black walnut. And he doesn't use just one kind of plastic cutting board. He uses four different chemical formulas, four different types of polymers, so that he's got different kinds of plastics. And so he's got 10 wooden boards, four plastic boards, and he puts those nasty germs on all of them. And guess what happens? Within 3 minutes of inoculating the wooden boards with cultures of the food poisoning agents, 99.9% of the bacteria were unrecoverable. They were gone. They were gone. On the other hand, none of the bacteria tested under similar conditions on plastic died. In fact, when they were left overnight, they grew. The microbes on the plastic multiplied. The ones on the wood, they're gone. And he found out by treating wood with oils and other finishes that that would retard the germicidal properties of wood. What he learned from this is that wood has a natural germicidal quality. For thousands of years, folks have been cooking and using wooden bowls in the kitchen. And they hadn't been getting germs from it. Did you know? Well, does the Bible have anything to say about this? I'm going to suggest to you that the Bible talks about this. Listen up. Germ control, according to Moses, 3,500 years ago. Leviticus 15, verse 11. And whomever the one who has the discharge touches. Now, here's a person, they've got some kind of illness or sickness or something. Maybe they've got pus or blood or something coming from their body, and they touch it, he says, and has not rinsed his hands in water, he shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be clean until evening. Three things you're supposed to do. Wash your hands, wash your clothes, and take a bath. If you touch anything that comes out of the body. Now, we understand that things come out of the body sometimes pretty nasty and have germs in them. But I want you to notice the next verse. The vessel of earth that he who has the discharge touches shall be broken, and every vessel of wood shall be rinsed in water. In other words, here's a person who has a discharge, and they've touched that discharge, and then they go touch a clay bowl or something that's made out of clay, some kind of pottery. You know what the law of Moses says? You bust it. You break it. You throw it away. You never use it again. But what if you touch a wooden bowl? Moses says you rinse it out, put it up on the shelf, and use it again. Why? Because wood has these antibacterial qualities about it. So I find that fascinating. Here's Moses and here's Dr. Cliver, and they both agree on the germicidal qualities of wood. Now, Moses didn't understand all that, by the way. But how did he know about those wooden bones? I suggest to you that God told him. It's just that simple. And so I find these kinds of things fascinating. I find them faith-building. You may not. I hope you do. I hope these are things that will help us to understand more about God and the things that he revealed many years ago. We get away from germs for a minute and talk about something else. And I obviously believe this was scientific foreknowledge from God. Talk about circumcision on the eighth day. Some of you may be aware of this. But when you think about circumcision, of course, this was something that was given to Abraham many years ago. Genesis chapter 17, verse 11, "And you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskins, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you." And then he says in verse 12, "He who is 8 years old among you shall be circumcised. Every male child in your generations, he who is born in your house or bought with money from any foreigner who is not your descendant." And the interesting thing about this, that even if the child turned 8 days old on the Sabbath day, the child was circumcised and the Sabbath was violated. Or the Sabbath had an exception, whichever way you want to look at it. Because Moses says, you circumcise a male child on the eighth day. That's the day. Well, 1 in 200 babies would bleed to death if the circumcision was performed on the wrong day. You reckon Moses ran a statistical analysis, and as they circumcised thousands of babies, they did it on different days to see which ones lived and died? I don't think so. He just says, do it on the eighth day. And it's interesting. If the surgery takes place on the eighth day, there's no chance of bleeding to death because of the high prothrombin count. On that day, the safest day for surgery is day eight. And Dr. S.I. MacMillan, again, in his book, None of These Diseases, says three things are necessary for blood to clot: vitamin K, platelets, and prothrombin. On day one, that male child has a 90% level of the prothrombin level that it would normally have. On days 2 through 5, it drops to 30%. Very good chance the child bleeding to death during that time. But on day 8, it jumps to 110%. 10% higher than it would be for the rest of the child's life. Dr. MacMillan says on the eighth day, the amount of prothrombin present actually is elevated above 100% of normal, and is the only day in which the male's life, in which this will be the case under normal circumstances. If surgery is to be performed, day 8 is the perfect day to do it. Vitamin K and prothrombin levels are at their peak on the eighth day when that male child is 8 days old. And that's what Moses said 3,500 years ago. You do this on the eighth day. And so, was that just another one of these lucky guesses? Or was that scientific foreknowledge from God? Let me suggest to you something else. The Old Testament had laws on quarantine. And it's interesting that Moses was practicing this 1,000 years before it was ever known of in history anywhere else. Quarantine is defined as enforced isolation or restriction of free movement imposed to prevent the spread of contagious diseases. Germs. He's eliminating germs again. And the earliest known date of a quarantine is in 549 A.D. Actually, Moses instituted this 2,000 years before this. In the wake of one of history's most devastating epidemics of bubonic plague, the Byzantine Emperor Justinian enacted a law meant to hinder and isolate people arriving from plague-infested regions. But Moses knew about that 2,000 years before that. He knew about it 3,500 years ago. And there's so many of these passages that you could look at. We don't have time to look at all of them. But Leviticus 13, verses 45 and 46. Now the leper on whom the sore is, his clothes shall be torn and his head bare. He shall cover his mustache and cry, unclean, unclean. He shall be unclean all the days he has the sore. He shall be unclean. He is unclean and he shall dwell alone. His dwelling shall be outside the camp. Now all my life up until 3 or 4 months ago, I did preach this in a gospel meeting. And after the gospel meeting, the fellow came up to me and said, I want to tell you something about this. In fact, he brought me some information off the computer. They were to cover their mustache. And I thought they were to cover their mustache because they were not supposed to breathe on people. What he pointed out to me, and what he brought me a copy from the internet, is that leprosy is transferred to people not through the mouth, but through the nose, through the nasal passages, hair coming out of the nose. And so they put their hand over their mustache, they covered their mustache. How did Moses know about that? I didn't even know that. I think it's fascinating. In Numbers 5, verses 1 through 4, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the children of Israel that they put out of the camp every leper, everyone who has a discharge, and whoever becomes defiled by a corpse, you shall put out both male and female. You shall put them outside the camp, that they may dwell, that they may not defile their camps in the midst of which they dwell. And the children of Israel did so and put them outside the camp, as the Lord spoke to Moses, so the children of Israel did. They followed these laws of quarantine. And I think it's fascinating that Moses knew something about quarantine 3,500 years ago. Was that just another lucky guess on Moses' part? Or was this scientific foreknowledge from God? One last point. I'm going to talk about human waste disposal. I mentioned this one time. Somebody said, surely you're not going to talk about this in a sermon. Yeah, I am. We're going to preach the whole counsel of God. We're not going to get it all in tonight, but we're going to talk about something that's never been talked about here before, I'm sure. Human waste disposal. Did you know Moses dealt with it? Did you know that armies have been defeated by flies as a result of not burying their waste? Flies carry diseases which make the soldiers sick and sometimes cause death. Armies today have policies concerning the proper disposal of human waste, and it is necessary to maintain proper sanitation. I have a friend of mine, a retired Army colonel. I said, do you have rules concerning human waste disposal? He said, you better believe that every Army does. And there are regulations that you have to go by. Did you know that during the Civil War, more people died from diseases than from battle wounds? You know what? This had a lot to do with it. They didn't properly dispose of human waste. Well, there were other things, obviously, but this was part of it. Proper disposal of human waste is important to avoid pollution of water sources, avoid the negative implications of someone else finding it, minimizing the possibility of spreading disease, and maximizing the rate of decomposition. We don't think much about that today because we have 3 or 4 rooms in our house called a bathroom. And we go do our business, and we pull the handle, and it's over. So we don't think about this, do we? But if you get on the internet and you look up the proper disposal of human waste outside of modern facilities, You're going to find exactly the same thing today. The people of today have not improved one iota over what Moses said 3,500 years ago. Moses told them to practice proper and safe sanitation. Deuteronomy chapter 23, verses 12 and 13. Also, you shall have a place outside the camp where you may go out, and you shall have an implement among your equipment, and when you sit down outside, you shall dig with it and turn and cover your refuse. Now, that's not hard to understand. The New International Version puts it this way. As part of your equipment, have something to dig with, and when you relieve yourself, dig a hole and cover up your excrement. Moses was teaching this 3,500 years ago. And when I got on the internet and looked this up and tried to find an example of proper human disposal, this is what I found. This image right here, this drawing, that's exactly what Moses said 3,500 years ago. I hope you find these things fascinating. I do. I don't believe these were lucky guesses on the part of Moses. I believe it was scientific foreknowledge from God. God told Moses, and Moses wrote it down. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Psalm 14, verse 1. These are some examples, I think, of things that prove that the Bible is not from man. Man couldn't come up with those things. Moses did because God directed him in the writing of these things. I think these things help to shore up our faith. And I think these are the kinds of things that you can share with other people, some that really don't have much faith in God. I believe you can share these kind of things with people and they'll say, you know, maybe there's something to this book. Maybe there is. Are you a child of God? If you're not, why don't you become one? I'll tell you what, our God, He is alive. He's just as real as He can be. And someday we're going to stand before Him in judgment. Last night we talked about 10 things that would transpire on the day of the Lord and the day of God. If you're not ready to meet God, it's going to be a horrible, horrible day. But if you are ready to meet God, it will be the day of greatest rejoicing and praise that you'll ever know. Do you believe that Jesus is the Son of God? Would you repent of your sins and confess Christ and be buried with your Lord in baptism? The Bible says when you do that, you rise to walk in newness of life. If you're subject to the invitation tonight in any way, we invite you to come as we stand and sing.